Welcome back to 45 North. I'm Ann Strangechamps, and we're celebrating the Wisconsin Science Festival on the air today with acclaimed evolutionary biologist Sean Carroll. He's a professor of molecular biology and genetics at the UW-Madison, internationally recognized for his work on genetics and evolution. He is also one of his generation's most admired science storytellers. You might remember his last book, Remarkable Creatures, which was a finalist for the National Book Award. You may have seen his work on NOVA, read his column in the New York Times. He's also the architect of a $60 million science filmmaking program. And the common feature in all of Sean's work is his passion for great stories about science and scientists. And he's got a brand new book just out, Brave Genius. Sean, welcome.
Thanks, Anne.
Great to have you here. So the subtitle of your new book is The Scientist, the Philosopher, and Their Daring Adventures from the French Resistance to the Nobel Prize. And this is a true story. The characters are two of the most famous figures in the history of 20th century ideas, Camus and Jacques Monod. Tell us about them.
Well, as I think you said in your intro a few minutes ago, if you had met them on the streets of Paris in 1940, you probably wouldn't have thought much. Monod was a relatively underachieving and old graduate student, and Camus had just arrived from Algeria and was working on a mediocre newspaper. And it was really the invasion of France by the Germans that changed the path of their lives and really propelled them onto future greatness. And it was a lot of twists of circumstance that led them to be in the position to either make great discoveries or say great things at just the right time.
So this was kind of a departure for you, though, a story about literary and political history as well as biology. I mean, how did you even stumble on this story?
Yeah, departure is a really good word. I knew about Monod because his work was central to modern biology. And over many years, I had read bits and pieces that had mentioned once or twice that he knew Camus. And I knew a little bit about Camus because it just so happens that as an undergraduate, I also studied French and French literature. And when I read Monod's writing, it was clear to me that Camus had an obvious influence. And I just, that thought just sat in my head for years and years and years and years until I decided to figure out, well, was there something really to this? And if I could find concrete evidence of it, maybe there was a story there. And if I couldn't, I would drop it.
And part of the story is, I mean, so there's the actual story itself, which we'll get to, which is just a great kind of colorful, dramatic story. But there's a subtext that runs all the way through this, which is partly a story about genius, kind of what it is, what shapes it. I mean, your argument is that in many ways, World War II was the catalyst for both Albert Camus and Jacques Monod's genius. Am I right?
Yeah, there's an entry in one of Camus' notebooks as early as 1942 where he says there's an element of chance to the root of genius. And I think he's absolutely right. And there was another phrase I came across from another writer saying that genius was talent lit on fire by courage. And I think that having experienced what they did, that gave them such a sense of urgency, such a sense of purpose after the war, that their energies, you know, every fiber of their being was dedicated to their creative work and to their engagement in the world's larger issues. So these were not ivory tower artists or academics. These were people very much engaged in the affairs of their times, both during the war and after.
Well, just to stay with thinking about genius for a minute, that's so interesting because the, you know, the model we've had for so long, the idea about genius is that it's inborn.
Yeah, I think we're, I mean, thinking evolves about this, and of course, lots of different people are going to have the opinion. I mean, there's something there about having some sort of ability, but circumstance plays such a large role. And you think, especially around the time of World War, how many geniuses never made it out of the war. And in the case of Camus and Monod, really, they were flung into certain circumstances that, you know, no one could have foreseen. In Camus' case, it's very clear. It was really almost a matter of attrition that led him to be editor of an underground newspaper called Combat, or Combat. And at the time of the liberation of Paris, it was his job to put these editorials out on the front page of this newspaper. And those editorials, I think, are some of the most inspiring and eloquent writing in the history of journalism. Day after day, in the heat of the Battle of Paris, Camus just summoned the right words. They were anonymous editorials at first, but when the public found out who had written these incredible words, they loved him for it. And then he had, right as soon as Paris was liberated, he had a pulpit to sort of shape the renewal of France. And he took France, his editorials were in a really unexpected direction, where it was not focused on retribution or revenge, sort of settling old scores, but how to rebuild a country based on justice.
So he really used that pulpit to take France in a direction.
That's right. And one of his colleagues in the resistance said, you know, this is one of the happy accidents that not only shapes the lives of individuals, but of whole societies. Mm. He was the talk of the nation.
Well, let's go back and tell some of this story. So we're starting in the late 30s, early 40s, and the World War II is going on. The Nazi Germany has invaded France. Paris is occupied. What did Jacques Monod and Albert Camus do? And at the time, they didn't know each other, right?
No, they didn't know each other. I'll start with Monod. Monod, during the long phase between the invasion of Poland and the invasion of France, Monod re-enlisted essentially in the army because he was 30 years old. He had already served his mandatory military service, but he wanted to do something to use his scientific talent. So he joined the communication engineers. He never really got to do anything because France was overwhelmed in a matter of days. And so when he and his wife returned to Paris, he returned to graduate school trying to find a research problem. But the situation darkened so quickly in Paris. His wife was Jewish. Monod was not. But a series of anti-Jewish restrictions came into effect, and Monod started talking to peers and friends about what could be done. And at first, it was really just to share information among people who felt the same way, that, you know, this was a horrible circumstance. All the media in France was controlled by the Germans, so their only hope and their only lifeline to the outside world was the BBC. So they were going to start a newsletter that they would circulate then among a small circle of friends and academics to share information and to inspire some hope. And that was really a very early phase of the resistance, and Monod was involved there.
But Monod wound up rising pretty quickly in the French resistance movement and wound up doing very dangerous work.
Yeah, so the first effort that I'm telling you about, I don't want to give away all the story, but the first effort ended badly. But Monod got a second chance, and he then joined the most militant wing of the resistance and rose to become the chief of staff for operations by 1944. And that involved organizing arms drops and sabotage and communications across the country, funneling in money, sending intelligence reports out to the Allies that would guide bombing campaigns. And then he was right on scene for the civilian uprising that led to the liberation of Paris.
Wow. So what was his day-to-day life like during this period? Was he, you know, pretending to go about his daily life and what was he then, still a student, or was he working as a scientist?
He was working as a scientist. He earned his doctorate during the occupation, and he was trying to live a double life for quite a while. And he was fairly newly married, and he had a new set of twins that were really born just a month before war broke out. So he was juggling, and he tried to keep up that appearance of sort of working by day and the resistance by night, but eventually he had to go full time into the resistance. And that was both level. His superior was arrested and tortured. One of his friends was arrested and deported, and he was afraid that he would be found. So he started wearing a disguise, sleeping in safe houses. He stayed away from his laboratory at the Sorbonne. He was fully immersed in the resistance, and it became a round-the-clock job.
Wow. So he must have, I mean, what would have happened to him if he had been caught?
Well, it's always arrest and torture to try to get information out of you. And then generally, if you weren't shot on site, and things became more were shot on site in probably the 6 months leading up to the invasion of Normandy. But deportation was pretty much certain to one of the concentration camps. And so that was the fate of many resistance members who were caught.
Mm. And he was working with a team. It wasn't just him alone. What about the other people who were working with him?
Well, that's a great question because I've gotten to meet them.
Wow.
His assistant in the resistance is a woman named Geneviève Nouflard. She was a music student at the time. Monod was very talented in music and even conducted a chorus in Paris during the occupation. And she figured out from some of things she talked about with Minot that he was in the resistance, and she asked in and became his assistant. And she did daily rounds around Paris, usually on bicycle, all sorts of rendezvous to exchange information, intelligence reports, things like this. It was really exhausting, nerve-wracking work because she had to memorize all the aliases of these contacts. She had to memorize locations, which changed from day to day, and she had to memorize the information that she was told. And I know all this because she is alive and well, 93 years old, and still living in the house in Paris out of which they conducted a lot of these operations.
Oh, that's just extraordinary. I just can't imagine what it would be like to meet somebody who had done that sort of thing. What is she like?
She's a magnificent lady. She was a very accomplished concert flautist. So a very refined woman, very knowledgeable about art. Her parents were artists. And she had saved, really at some risk, she had saved various orders, documents, maps, things like this from her time in the resistance. And she also turned them over to me, and some of them are illustrated in the book. These would be sabotage maps or orders that Minot dictated, the most important of which was it was Minot who issued the order to start building barricades in Paris during the civilian uprising. That's something that historians don't know, I think, until 3 days ago when my book was published, that that episode, which is really what trapped the Germans and really marked the uprising, started with an order from Minot's hand. And it's funny because as Genevieve tells the story, Minot said, he finished dictating this order, and he said, well, it'll never be followed. It's a shame because it might be successful. And within 2 days, there were barricades all over Paris.
Wow. Tell more of that story, would you? I mean, sort of set the stage, because it wasn't – was this before – I'm trying to remember my military history. Was this before or after D-Day?
This is after D-Day. So the Allies landed in Normandy on June 6, 1944. The resistance did a lot to prepare for that because as the landings took place and Minot, there were code words that went out over the BBC for the resistance to know that the invasion was imminent. No one in the resistance, including Charles de Gaulle, was given the exact date of the invasion for reasons of security. But there were code words to say, first, that the invasion was imminent, and second, in fact, that it was ongoing. These were broadcast over the BBC. And as soon as the resistance heard that, Minot and all of his colleagues across the country had organized a series of operations that were going to cut rail lines, block roads, hamper the Germans' movements so they couldn't respond to the Normandy beaches. And they were very successful at slowing down the movement of large German divisions all across France. Mm-hmm. They also really upped their sabotage activities, sabotage of trains, sabotage of electrical plants, of production facilities. And so that summer, June, July, August, it was a tremendous amount of sabotage activity and then outright combat with armed resistance.
But in terms of the liberation of Paris, isn't that usually often told as a story of the Allies sweeping in and liberating Paris, whereas you're telling it as a story of the resistance having kind of broken the German occupation from within?
Well, the resistance was, I think, very important in softening up and hampering the Germans, sort of a behind the lines activity, while the Allies were bringing massive force. The resistance on its own was so outgunned and so outmanned, there's no way it was going to dislodge the Germans. In terms of the liberation of Paris, this started in the last 10 to 12 days of August of 1944. It was a civilian uprising. The resistance took over some buildings. Civilians essentially were finding old weapons, that whatever they could, and starting to show a lot of hostility towards the occupiers. And the Allied armies were still a good distance away. And it was quite a political football as to, well, would the Allies come to Paris? Because that was going to be expensive in terms of resources and time, whereas at that time the Allies were trying to push the German army all the way across France back to the borders of Germany. And the decision was eventually made by Eisenhower to head towards Paris, but a promise he had made to the French was to let French troops be the first. And so a division led by General Leclerc was the first into France. And the Allies, after several days of street fighting between civilians, resistance, and the Germans, the Allies came in and sort of mopped up the job around the 24th, 25th of August. And technically, the 25th of August, Paris was declared liberated.
Mm-hmm. Sean, it's such a gripping story, you know, just in and of itself as a piece of military history and political history. why is, but it's also, this is a piece of scientific history, because we're talking about Jacques Monod, who later won Nobel Prize for biology, or shared in it. Why is it important to you to tell this also as a scientific story?
Well, I think it puts a human face on science. We're not all ivory tower, you know, nerds in white lab coats, totally detached from the world around us. And Monod is a good example of that contrast. And I think especially because there's an entry in his notebook I was able to find from about November of 1940. So this is when the occupation is just really becoming in force. And there's a little piece of graph paper and a little blip in a plot on that graph paper that 25 years later is going to be a Nobel Prize. That he made the first observation that was going to lead to that great path of science at a horrible time, and in fact at a time where he was spending some of his time trying to get resistance launched. And I think that sense of being engaged marked the rest of Monod's life, the next 35 years. So it wasn't just the active resistance against the Germans. He became a very vocal critic of the Soviet Union during the Cold War. He was pulled into really dramatic events later on, involved in the Hungarian Revolution, all this time being an incredibly creative scientist.
We're talking about science and storytelling this morning with Sean B. Carroll. He's a professor of molecular biology, genetics, and medical genetics at the UW-Madison. He also leads the Department of Science Education of the Howard Hughes Medical Institute, and he's a recent recipient of the Benjamin Franklin Medal in Life Science. When we come back, we'll take calls from you as well. Do you see a relationship yourself between science and storytelling? You can join our conversation by calling 1-800-642-1234 or chime in on our Facebook page, 45 North. On WPR. You're listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Ann Strange Jampson. You're listening to 45 North on Wisconsin Public Radio. This morning we're talking with Sean B. Carroll. He's an evolutionary biologist and the author of a terrific new book, Brave Genius, A Scientist, a Philosopher, and Their Daring Adventures from the French Resistance to the Nobel Prize. He'll also be talking at the Wisconsin Science Festival this weekend. Details about that on our Facebook page, 45 North on WPR. And Sean, we've been talking about Jacques Monod, but your book is about two people, these two great friends, Jacques Monod, the biologist, and Albert Camus, the writer, both of whom would go on to win Nobel Prizes. What was Camus' experience of the war like?
Well, he was working at a newspaper when the invasion came, and he considered getting out of the country, but didn't make that decision in time. He was toiling in his spare time on a novel that we would know later as The Stranger. So he sort of bounced around France for a bit and then went to Algeria for a while. He was originally from Algeria, and of course Algeria at this time was part of France, and made his way back to France sort of in the middle of the conflict. And that's when he started becoming in contact with some friends who were parts of the resistance, both artists, even some journalists. And he started writing some clandestine articles in opposition to the Germans, and that was the beginnings even of a novel that was later published called The Plague, until finally he moved back to Paris and joined the team producing this newspaper called Combat, an underground newspaper. And as various members either had other duties or were arrested, get them to her. She was actually team in her phone book with a very simple code that the Gestapo could have easily broken. So this was a tremendous amount of luck to simply not be caught. It was, and I think that's where the anxiety came, because you had no idea whether it was a neighbor or a colleague or somebody might have observed something and there'd be a knock on your door and it'd be over with. And that happened to lots of people in both Camus and Monod's spheres.
Camus said later that there was nothing like writing with the fear of death hanging over you to make you really think about the impact and the power of words. How do you think these experiences shaped him as a writer?
Well, I mean, this is obviously, these were life and death stakes, and he was trying to inspire resistance all through the critical months and year of 1944 to rally the French against the occupiers. This was tricky because a significant part of the French population was collaborating with the Germans and sort of getting along well enough. And he had to arouse their conscience. Others felt that they couldn't be effective and so were sort of staying out of the fray, but Camus was trying to encourage everyone to, in some whatever way they possibly could, to resist the occupiers. And he thought that was important both to expel the occupiers, but also in terms of what kind of country would France be after the occupation, after liberation. The sense was that, you know, in time, France would get liberated, didn't know what price they would have to pay for it. But it'd sort of be like, you know, how would you account for yourself if you stood idly by and did nothing? Mm-hmm. So he was really trying, you know, so he used pretty inflammatory rhetoric against the Germans. And so, you know, if he was caught, it was all over.
Now, so far we've been telling the story of these two separate men and their separate careers in the French Resistance, but they met after the war ended and they became friends. And it's such a fascinating story of friendship across disciplines, because here's this great biologist and here's this brilliant literary writer. And in some ways, they had more in common with each other.
They hit it off right away because Camus was having the same thoughts about the Soviet regime as Minot had put out in his article. And they really sort of conspired and certainly had lots and lots of conversations about everything that was wrong with Stalinism and what was going on in the Soviet sphere. And that that was their first bond.
Mm-hmm. And, you know, earlier we touched on that question of that issue of trying to humanize science a little bit. And I guess this is another kind of crossroads that you're dealing with, not just an intellectual crossroads, but, you know, for a long time we've been taught to see biology and the humanities as pretty separate spheres. Was that important to you, or is that kind of a subtext of the book to break that down a bit?
Well, I think breaking that down a bit, I sort of have different threads of motivation for doing that. I think that the same sort of passions drive scientists as drive, you know, artists and musicians and writers. And so I don't like science. I don't think it's accurate to think of science as sort of an entirely separate sort of activity. And second of all, that I think science has an important contribution to make to our culture, as does music and art and literature. And this story was appealing to me because I think it underscores the sort of contributions that science could make to society, because it was played a very important role in shaping thought at the time. The Soviet ideology was demonstrably false from a scientific point of view, and the Soviet Union went down some really stupid paths in terms of science after the war to try to sort of Sovietize science, and they were abandoning Western ideas and Western discoveries to sort of create their own sort of brand of science, and it ruined Soviet biology, absolutely crippled it really for ever since. Never really recovered. And so it's amazing to see stories of, you know, large states, you know, making incredibly stupid decisions that flew in the face of scientific thinking at the time.
Yeah, but it's also so interesting to see the story of the development of a particular science in these very human and political and social terms, to see the ways in which, because so often we tell the story of science as science happens in a lab somewhere removed from, you know, ordinary political reality or the social lives of everybody else. We think of science as pure, right? Cut off from all of that, but it's not.
Well, it's not cut off. I think the question is which direction the arrow goes. I think when politics drives science, most of us think that's not such a good thing. I think when science can inform politics, that can be a good thing, meaning it can inform decision-making. And in the case of what caused Minot to speak up was that politics was causing the abandonment of well-established science in the Soviet Union. And that was a reflection of a much deeper disease going on in the Soviet Union, which was pretty much the rewriting of history, the rewriting of economic knowledge as well. So it was a flag that especially in Europe at this time, a lot of people were looking to the Soviet Union as a model of socialism. And Camus and Minot were waving the flag saying, you know, wait a minute, folks, this regime is just as bad as the one we just fought during World War II, if not worse in certain ways. And that was not a popular position. That cost Camus a lot of his friends on the French left. So this friendship with Minot was blossoming just at the time that his rather famous friendship with the writer Jean-Paul Sartre was dissolving. And it was over the same issue, which was the right or wrongs of the Soviet Union.
We're talking with Sean Carroll about his new book, Brave Genius, story of the biologist Jacques Monod and writer Albert Camus and their friendship. We're also talking about science and storytelling and the kinds of stories that we tell about science. And you can join the conversation. I'm curious, do you see a relationship between science and storytelling? And are there kinds of stories you would like to hear more of about science? You can join the conversation by calling 1-800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or chime in on our Facebook page, 45 North on WPR. You know, Sean, after the war, I want to talk about kind of the intellectual directions both these guys went, Monod and Camus, after the war. Because after all of the horror of the Holocaust, a very common response was nihilism. Camus, at least, rejected that and went in a much more kind of life-affirming direction, I guess you could say. Is that right?
That's absolutely right. And I think that's why people responded to him in enormous numbers, which was, I think, nihilism was the easy way, essentially saying there was no point, that really life was futile. And Camus, especially, and he had these ideas for a long time, Camus was really interested in the question of, you know, given the gift of life, how do we live it? And his response was, well, we just live it fully, knowing that it's finite. We live it fully, and that's the best that we can do. And that's what he tried to express in essays, sort of directly, things like The Myth of Sisyphus, but in his novels, like The Plague, like The Stranger, that to really give people some sense of, you know, what is a life well lived?
Did he have a recipe for living life to the fullest? I mean, what did that mean?
I think that meant using your powers of reason and sort of having the courage to face the fact that we had a finite lifetime, and then living it, you know, to the maximum. Now, that might be different for different people, but he felt that, you know, striving, just the struggle to live a life fully, was, in his view, enough to make one happy.
And what about Monod's response to, you know, after World War II? Because I'm thinking it was also in some ways profoundly hopeful. He dedicated the rest of his life to exploring the secrets of life as a scientist.
Absolutely. So, no, I think that's what happened, is that Camus, his writings resonated with so many French coming out of the war, and Monod was one of them. So I think that he, you know, immediately embraced this Camus perspective. It was very positive. It was very hopeful. And it was also very, Camus so much emphasized the act of creation, that sort of, you know, of all the things we do in life, the sort of one of the major contributions we can make is whatever we create. And I think Monod responded to that in a great way. And so this was, you know, this dynamic between them of sort of creation and art and creation and science, I think this is what they found to be, you know, a very satisfying outlet for all that passion they had for life.
And this was before the genetic revolution, the discovery of the double helix structure of DNA. What was Monod working on? I mean, what's his great contribution?
So his great contribution is understanding how genes work. So he knew the principles involved in solving the structure of DNA. In fact, Jim Watson, when Watson came up with the solution late February 1953, one of the first people he told was Jacques Monod. He slipped over to Paris for sort of a fun trip, dropped in at the Pasteur Institute and let Monod know what they had found out. So Monod was very much an insider to the major discoveries that were going on, and he and his collaborators were working on the question of how genes actually work. So it was a complete mystery how genes controlled the characteristics of creatures. And starting with work that began in 1940 and marching right through about 1960, especially those last few years of the late 50s, he cracked open the puzzle with his close collaborator, François Jacob, of how genes work, and especially the idea of a gene switch, how genes are turned on and off in organisms in response to the environment. And for that, he won the Nobel Prize. I would just insert, Anne, for a second, that one of the sort of tipping points that made me decide to write this book is when I learned from someone I started to interview, a woman named Agnes Ullmann in Paris, that during those last couple of years of the 1950s, when Monod was doing his most intense creative work that was going to result in the Nobel Prize, he was working on the smuggling of Agnes and her husband out of Hungary. And this was a secret operation. Monod raised a substantial amount of money, worked through various intermediaries, took 2 years, various schemes fell apart. But eventually Agnes and her husband were smuggled out from Hungary underneath the bathtub in a pull-along camping trailer. And when I learned that that's how Monod spent his other time while doing his Nobel Prize-winning work, I thought this was a story worth telling.
We're talking with Sean B. Carroll. He's a professor of molecular biology, genetics, and medical genetics at the University of Wisconsin-Madison. He also leads the Department of Science Education at the Howard Hughes Medical Institute. And we're talking about his new book, just came out, Brave Genius, A Scientist, A Philosopher, and Their Daring Adventures from the French Resistance to the Nobel Prize. He'll be taking part in the Wisconsin Science Festival this weekend. Details on our Facebook page at 45 North on WPR. And you can join the conversation. When we come back, we're going to talk more about science and storytelling and what kinds of stories we would like to hear more about. You can join the conversation at 1-800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or email us. The address is talk@wpr.org. You're listening to 45 North on Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Anne Strange-Shemps, and we're talking with Sean B. Carroll today about his new book, Brave Genius, A Scientist, A Philosopher, and Their Daring Adventures from the French Resistance to the Nobel Prize. And we've got callers on the line. Alex joins us from Madison. Good morning, Alex.
Good morning.
Hi, did you have a question or comment?
Yes. First of all, I'm driving from Madison to Dayton, Ohio today, so I very much appreciate having such an interesting program on. And I recently read Timothy Ferris's book, The Science of Liberty, and was really interested in the stories of the founding fathers and politicians also being active scientists. I just wondered if that influenced your research in any way, or if you relate anything in your book to sort of the same way the founding fathers were a good group of scientists.
Oh, great question. Sean?
Well, it's a great question. It's a good plug for another book. Thomas Jefferson is credited with really writing the first paper on paleontology in the United States. And so I'm aware of some of the scientific activities of the founding fathers. And I was, in a previous story, really fascinated with the fact that Jefferson was a voracious fossil collector and even had folks like Lewis and Clark out looking for fossils as they made their journey. So I think that that's just a great reflection on the sort of enlightened minds that were involved in the founding of our country. And they were interested in not only just systems of government and individual liberties, but they were interested, of course, in whatever knowledge could be gained about the world. And that was, of course, still an age of great exploration where we didn't know much about what was on the interior of our country and very little about the history of the world, certainly the natural history of the world whatsoever. So their appetites, I would love to see more of that appetite in Washington, D.C.
Well, I'm curious about, I keep saying we're going to talk about science and storytelling. And, you know, in addition to writing books, you also are the architect of this $60 million science filmmaking project at the Howard Hughes Medical Institute. What is it you're wanting to do with science on film?
Well, film is a really powerful way to tell stories. I'm saying this on the radio, I understand. But
we'll
moving images and moving images and all sorts of things that you can do on film, it's a great mass medium. And so, understanding that, I thought that one way we could reach both classroom audiences as well as the general public with some interesting science stories was through film. And so that endeavor started a couple of years ago. We'll see some of the first broadcast films will be coming out in 2014, but there's a significant number of shorter films that are already being used in classrooms. And you can find out more about that by going to hhmi.org. to the Bio Interactive site. And anyone who's an educator should go there because all those materials are available for free, whether that's on DVD or streaming or download, et cetera. But all the educational media that we make at the Hughes Institute are available for free.
And are there particular kinds of science stories you'd like to see told more in film?
Well,
I mean, I'm thinking along the lines of partly of the kind of more humanized story that you've been telling right now, the story not just of scientific ideas, but of scientific ideas embodied, you know, in the personality and the history and the emotion of, you know, somebody who's working in science.
Well, I think you put it very well. That's exactly, I think, what we'd like to see more of. I think that, you know, scientists are part of the rest of society, and they have all of their peculiarities and faults and values, just like the rest of us. And I think that in particular, when someone has lived a scientifically important life, it's interesting to take a peek in there. I think we're interested in the lives of artists. We're interested in the lives of musicians. We're even interested in the lives of writers. We should be interested in the lives of scientists. What drove them?
More than that, I would say, you know, as a former English major, you know, there are generations of critics who take it for granted that if you're going to talk about, say, Pride and Prejudice or any other great novel, it's fair game to talk about the emotional life, the personal life of the writer, and to explore the work through the personal life. But we never do that with science, or very rarely, only in the case of the really eminent scientists, Einstein or Niels Bohr or somebody.
Right. And I think that that's just missing the opportunity to have a peek inside what drives scientists. You know, what's in their souls? What's in their lives? What are they trying to offer? What are they striving for? And you'll find the same spectrum of humanity among scientists that you will among any other particular, you know, group of individuals. But I think that those who are who make extraordinary accomplishments, I think those are particularly interesting lives to look at. What are the factors that go into that? What was driving them? Was it, you know, tremendous hardship, as it was in the case of Minot? Was it, you know, some sort of dream of inventing something? Was it a delusion, as in the case of some scientists I could talk about? So, you know, I think these are valuable things to look into. I think they humanize science. And among the scientific community, I think one of our greatest concerns is that it's that the general public doesn't have a great feel for what the scientific process is. Because regardless of what that person is, there's a reason why science is an effective way of gaining knowledge about the world. And so depicting that in story form is, I think, a really effective way of getting some sense of the way ideas are tested, how evidence is gathered, how mistakes get made, how things get corrected. And we should see more of that, because science plays a critical role in our everyday lives.
I'm going to go to another call. We've got Joe on the line from Prairie du Chien. Hi, Joe.
Hi. So I would suggest that science and art are this basically the same thing, just offshoots of a bigger question that a conscious mind has, which is, you know, what's really going on. Science would answer the how, and art goes to the why. And I think the common thread that ties the two together is mathematics. And I would also suggest a good book, if you're talking about a story, is A Beautiful Mind about Nash.
Oh, that's, yeah. And was also made into a film, wasn't it? The story about the mathematician who was also schizophrenic?
Yeah,
right.
It's a great book because it explains science in a way, but there's no equations, but it makes you understand the philosophical ideas that go on behind trying to really understand what's going on.
Yeah, Joe, thank you. That's a great call. And we've also got Phyllis on the line from Brookfield. Hi, Phyllis.
Hi. Thank you for taking my call. I'm so grateful for his wonderful awakening of this union of science and the storytelling that can be so important in helping us solve then the problem solving that our generation is faced with. And I love his ideas. I think it can contribute so much if we again follow through with this union of science and storytelling. Thank you.
Thanks, Phyllis, very much for your call. Sean, I'm curious. I want to sort of dig a little bit deeper into that concept of where the relationship between scientific ideas and somebody's emotional personal life. For instance, going back to thinking about Jacques Monod, you wrote, there's this line in the book that I really love. You said that Minot argued that science had shattered traditional concepts about our purpose and place in the world. And that being so, the choice remains how to find meaning in a scientifically enlightened world. What did he think about that?
He wrote at that at length in his book, Chance and Necessity. This was actually a bestseller in several countries, not the United States. I'll let you make your own conclusions there. But Minot very strongly argued that a lot of the belief systems that had guided humans for millennia just didn't hold up under new scientific knowledge, and that was particularly human's special place in life on Earth or even in the universe, that all the evidence we had was that humans were just another species that had come along and that chance had played an enormous role in that. So given that, for some folks, I would say, well, gee, if there's no purpose coming from without, how do we find purpose in life? And Minot offered, I would say, some thoughts. I wouldn't say some directives. And I think the thoughts were that, one of the characteristics of humans as a species is, we are knowledge creators. We are creators, creators in art, creators of knowledge. And that that could guide a fair amount of our priorities, that as we become more knowledgeable about the world and more creative, that has the possibility of generating a very high quality of life for people across the world. And so Minot thought that a lot of people could find purpose and direction in that of contributing essentially to the welfare of, fellow people.
Sounds like he was looking ahead to today's knowledge economy.
Yeah, and this was 1970, so that was pretty decent. So I don't think that Minot would even claim that he had an answer to that question. He had just some thoughts. In fact, he I think was going to put those thoughts in a second book called Man and Time, but he died at a relatively young age of 66 before he could complete that book.
Mm. There's a lovely episode you mentioned near the end of the book. It was near the end of Minot's life, and he got a letter from a young student who asked him, he wrote and said something like, "I admire you very much. My teacher tells me you are a very important biologist, so I want to ask you, what is your maxim for life?" And do you remember this letter?
Yes, it's beautiful. Bruno from Grenoble.
Yeah. So what? Tell us, what did Minot say? How did he write
back?
Well,
I'm trying to remember, but basically said if there was one maxim that would guide his life, and it's very hard to find one, he said it would be courage, both physical and moral. And I thought that was worth putting in the book because I think that I can find very few people who would have been able to live up to that maxim as Minot did. He acted on his moral sense by helping other people when he could, and he acted with great physical courage when the bell rang. So I thought that his answer to a 13-year-old boy from Grenoble was perfect.
Well, what it made me wonder was whether, not knowing that much about the science, what it made me wonder was whether he also demonstrated courage in his scientific thinking.
I think he did, but I don't know that I think he stuck his neck out pretty far and sometimes, caught flack for that. But I think that he was thinking in a broader sense. He later in life, especially after the Nobel Prize, he was a public figure in France. He, for example, was the person who introduced Martin Luther King to Paris when King made a visit in 1966. He eulogized King in 68 after his assassination. He was an important go-between. France was turned upside down by student riots in May of 1968. He was a go-between between the students and the government. So he was, very much a public figure. So I think he was thinking on a certain plane of, what gets us through this life and makes a better life is physical and moral courage.
Okay. We've got time for one more quick call. Let's go to Ron in La Crosse. Hi, Ron.
Yes. You alluded to the fact that in the Soviet Union, traditional science became purloined or debased by Soviet ideology. And I do remember a long time ago hearing on TV about this was this Soviet agricultural botanist who embraced the Soviet ideology, and he you know, he expounded that Russian version of science that was sort of reinforced, you know, the old communist ideology. And I can't remember his name, but I guess the commissar in charge of the agricultural portion of the Soviet government tried to implement his beliefs, and the result was a disaster in the wheat harvest. And I don't know if you remember that Soviet botanist's name.
Yes, he's in the book. His name is T.D. Lysenko. He was a favorite of Stalin's, and you're exactly right. He really became a critical force in Stalin's regime in terms of agricultural policy. It did lead to crop failures and famine. He also gutted essentially Soviet biology so that those biologists who were working in the area of genetics in particular were purged. Some were imprisoned. Some died in prison. And when Minot learned all this, he was absolutely aghast. And this is what Minot came out against publicly, was this perversion. And if you want to, how could this possibly happen? It was really Lysenko was trying to argue that basically through Soviet methodology, any crop could be improved very quickly, just sort of adapted to various growing conditions and things like this, even transforming one type of crop into another. So it started to become full of all sorts of fraudulent claims. But this is what he was arguing relative to the Western method, which was to select varieties patiently, carefully, generation after generation, and to gradually improve crops as we have here for hundreds of years. And I know that it seems, you know, it's almost unbelievable that a country would go down a path like that at such tremendous peril. But that's exactly what happened. And that was really the dangers of a state where you had a delusional dictator like Stalin and you had his henchmen. And either you pleased Stalin or you were gone. And because of that, biology in the Soviet Union really derailed.
Mm. Sean, it has been such a pleasure talking with you today. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
Yeah, so Sean B. Carroll is a professor of molecular biology, genetics, and medical genetics at the University of Wisconsin-Madison. He also leads the Department of Science Education at the Howard Hughes Medical Institute, and he's a recent recipient of the Benjamin Franklin Medal in Life Science. We've been talking about his brand new book, Brave Genius, a scientist, a philosopher, and their daring adventures from the French Resistance to the Nobel Prize. He'll be talking at the Wisconsin Science Festival, which is going on right now and all this weekend. You can find information about his talk and all the others on our Facebook page, which is 45 North on WPR. Thanks today to our producers, Marika Suval, Rhonda Fanning, a technical direction from Dave Potrez, and help from Joe Hartke. It's always fun talking with you on Friday mornings, and I'll look forward to joining you again next Friday here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.